And so, did you just want me to say dispatches from the underground? Dispatches from the underground.
Dispatches from the underground.
With your host,
Joey Steele. Up to no good. We're good?
Question authority.
Dispatches from the underground.
Question everything.
Dispatches from the underground!
All right, welcome to Dispatches from the Underground. I'm your host, Joey Steele. Thanks for getting down with us. We are coming at you from the underground in New York City. That's where we are. This is what we do. I'm glad you could join us down here. I know a lot of people out there have been getting down with some left-wing activism, and I'm really happy about that. I hope Dispatches is part of their trajectory into the left and into the radical world of the left-wing left. And, I just think that's where we all need to be living. I think that's where the world is headed. I think that's what's calling out to be done. And I know in doing that, a lot of things come into question, and you start doubting people you meet, and you questioning them, and you're not sure who they are, where they're coming from. And I get it. I've done radical left-wing activism for a long time, and I know those thoughts can creep into your mind, and those doubts can creep into your mind about, you know, why this other person that you're meeting is also in doing that stuff. And it can be a disconcerting thought process, and sometimes you can get paranoid, and sometimes you can be uncertain about them, and it's not a pleasant place to live. So I, you know, in the left, we in the radical left, we always had a way to deal with that, and that's like vetting the people you meet, not in like a fucking capitalist way, like vetting their experiences or whatever, but just talking to people. It's not like in some weird with like a fucking swinging light bulb above their head, like in some sort of fucking cop unit or in some sort of police precinct or whatever, but like talking to them as a human being and just understanding their experiences and knowing like how they ended up on the left, and just talking to them, getting to know their story is honestly, in my experience, how I was trained and how I got down with the radical left. That's always how we made sure people were there for the right reasons. And if people's stories don't make sense, well, then maybe you can take it to another level and start like, you know, vetting it on a more serious level, looking into their background and talking to some people they know. But to me, it's always just like, all right, let's listen to their story and let's talk to them. And a lot of newer people who are getting down with left-wing stuff, they're just not used to that, and they get paranoid about shit. And so an old friend of mine, a great human being, a wonderful radical, and an incredible writer, he just came out with a new book with another great friend of mine, Connor Gallagher. Aaron Leonard and Connor Gallagher just came out with this new book, and this is their second book. This book is called A Threat of the First Magnitude. It's about FBI counterintelligence and infiltration in the 60s and early 70s. And this is it's a great book. They're incredible writers. They're incredible researchers. And there's a ton of great information in it. That coupled with their last book, Heavy Radicals, which has like become the standard bearer in terms of understanding the FBI's experience in infiltrating left-wing groups in the 60s and 70s. And that book was called Heavy Radicals, The FBI's Secret War on America's Maoist in the History of the Revolutionary Union, the Revolutionary Communist Party. Anyway, they're both great books. And I wanted Aaron to come on to talk about his most recent book, because I think both of these books, not only are they great histories, and not only are they explaining like how the FBI works and the functions and the importance of actually knowing facts about what happened in the infiltration of left-wing movements, but it also can sort of calm some of our minds in understanding how to use evidence to suss out who is and isn't with us and against us, and how the government works and how we should work. I just think there's tons of ways that this information can be used. And in a world where I think all too often the left is simultaneously way too paranoid and also not paranoid enough, at least not about the right things. Paranoid is not the word, but not not cautious enough and all too fucking paranoid. I think it's important that we look at these books and look at the work that Aaron Leonard and Conor Gallagher are doing to try to help get our fucking heads on straight so we can start getting down with some left-wing shit and not getting turned around by the system. Anyway, Aaron is going to come on today, and we're going to be talking about this new book, A Threat of the First Magnitude. I hope you all get it. I hope you all get it for some friends. That book, coupled with their other book, Heavy Radicals, is a great source of information. He's going to be breaking some shit down. Maybe a little bit flies over our heads, as I got confused a little bit while he was talking. I think it's all going to make sense. But remember, this is a fucking podcast, people. So you can like stop it or rewind it and listen to it again. So if you get confused, and if you get confused, all the more reason why you should get the book so you can get the whole detail. Because we're going to try to squeeze like a lot of information in this episode, because Aaron is full of incredible information and I want to squeeze as much out of him as I can. I just want to make sure that through all of this, we don't turn ourselves into paranoid messes, and we don't lose sight of the fact that we need to get out of this system, and we need to get to a left-wing world where we can be more reflective and more considerate and more conscious of how everybody has needs. And we need to act in a way in accordance with that realization. So don't get paranoid. Don't lose sight. Don't fucking lose track of the fact that we need to get down with some radical shit, and hopefully we can start getting to that better place. So I want to say thank you to Aaron Leonard for coming on the show and doing this with us, talking about his new book, A Threat of the First Magnitude. I want to say thank you also to Real Punk Radio at realpunkradio.com. You can listen to this show, Dispatchers from the Underground, every Wednesday night, along with all their incredible programming over at Real Punk Radio. Please check that out, realpunkradio.com. I want to thank everybody who has continued to support this podcast, spreads the word, donates on our website. Anyone who comes up to me at shows, we just got off of a tour recently, and there's a couple of people who came up to me and said they listened to the show. I really appreciate knowing that y'all dig this. The whole reason we make this podcast is not for money, because we're losing it doing it. The whole reason we make this show is because we believe in being reflective and considerate, and we believe that punk music can be a threat to this system as long as we are reflective and we are conscious and we are empowering. And that's the point of this show, bringing the best, most radical, most down artists, musicians, and writers in this case to come and talk about the world we're headed into and the world we need to be headed into. And we appreciate everyone who is taking part in this by listening, who's coming on, and just always getting the fuck down. So thank you to everybody involved. Go to the website, dispatchersfromtheunderground.com. Stay more involved. We're on social media. Just search for Dispatchers from the Underground. Or on Facebook especially. And yeah, just, you know, stay with us. Get down with us. Spread the word. Donate if you can. Or just get involved in any way you're into it. Anyway, let's listen to some tunes. And let's get to a discussion with Aaron Leonard about his brand new book, A Threat of the First Magnitude. I think you're all going to dig it. Get down. Before we get to the discussion with Aaron, I want to listen to a tune. I don't know if y'all have been listening to Dispatches recently, but my band Skullcaster just did a tour with our friends Escape from the Zoo. We just put out a new record. You can get that record by going to our merch section on dispatchesfromtheunderground.com. It's going to be sold out soon, so make sure you go and get it. But while we were on tour, we played with a bunch of incredible fucking bands. And one of those bands was a good friend of mine who I hadn't seen in over 10 years. And this was a friend from Atlanta who actually was loosely associated with Aaron and I in some of the political work we did a long time ago. And that was my friend Kaz. And Kaz is in a band. I didn't even fucking know he was in a band. Kaz is in a band called Tiger Man Woe over near Boston. And we accidentally played with them on this one of the last days of this tour in Cambridge, a show that was put on by our good friends in Neighborhood Shit. Tiger Man Woe fucking blew me away. They were absolutely incredible. I cannot believe I did not know my friend from years ago was in this band, and I feel like a fucking idiot for not knowing and wasting all this time not knowing. Tiger Man Woe is putting out great music, conscious music, uplifting music with a great message and tons and tons and tons of heart. And I wanted to play a tune from that band right now. If you dig this, Wait till you finish the rest of this episode, then go and buy a bunch of their shit, because they're a fucking incredible band, and I think you're going to want to do it. So here is Tiger Man Woe from, I don't remember the name of the town they're from, and they're going to spit in my fucking face as soon as they see me. Because I forgot the name. I'm going to say Boston, but they're not technically from Boston. It's just like right outside Boston. But whatever. Spit in my face if you got to spit in my face. This is Tiger Man Woe from near Boston, Massachusetts. Get down. All right, Aaron, how you doing, brother?
Hey, it's good to be here, Joey.
It's been a long time. I haven't seen you in a couple of years, I think.
Yeah, well, and I was in New York City forever, and now I've finally moved to the left coast.
Oh, the left coast. Oh, that's a nice way to put it. It's a little dig at us. That's fine.
Yeah. Well, you know, what are you going to do?
Okay.
We're the fifth largest economy in the world.
Yeah, way to go. In the left side. I guess we got all the right things over here. Okay, that's fine. That's fine. No problem. I haven't really even talked to you since you put the last book out. I know you're here to talk about A Threat of the First Magnitude, but before we get to the new book, how's the last book doing? How's everything going? How's Heavy Radicals?
Heavy Radicals continues to, generate interest. People from time to time kind of pop up out of nowhere and want to interview me about it. And it's kind of becoming, the must read if you want to know about Maoism in the United States in the late 60s, early 70s, which is, you know, pretty gratifying. I mean, we didn't have any great aim. You know, that's the thing with books. It's like, you just got to do it.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not people like it is, you can't gear your life on what people will like or what they won't like. We just felt like we had to tell the story, and you know, we feel good that some people feel that story's worth checking out.
I mean, it's like a super duo putting you and Connor Gallagher together. Like, I've known you both for some time, and you're both two of the smartest people that I know, two of the most well-read, most nuanced, caring people about explaining exactly what you mean and knowing what you're talking about. To me, it's to an annoying level, you know?
Yeah, that's it. Well, we do work the annoying aspect there.
But you guys always know what you're talking about, even though I think you're wrong sometimes. Like, it's usually like only on the margins, you know, but never about facts. You guys know your shit more than anybody I know, and to a place that it's almost painful to talk to you about.
Yeah, well, you know, Connor really propelled me into, I mean, you know, I set out with a picture of a certain book, and then Connor said, well, hey, maybe we ought to ask the FBI for some documents, which sounds daunting, right? Oh, you got FBI documents. You know, you guys must, you know the intimacies of bureaucracy and know how to wear a suit and tie and all that. But there's a website, you know, just Google FOIA FBI, and, you know, website comes up. You click a link, you know, I want my file. Here's my name, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, with people who have died, you know, if you produce an obituary, you can ask. And the key thing with FBI stuff is ask, and maybe they'll give it to you. Who knows?
I mean, I've asked for my FBI files, Aaron, and I've gotten nothing. But I mean, maybe I'm not important enough to know. But, you know, it's you got to be persistent, which you guys are too. So, you know, you're persistent, you're knowledgeable. And I guess those two things together. And again, Connor, he's not here to defend himself. Super annoying dude. But you know, those qualifications together, I feel like produce great intellectuals and great writers. I might be wrong. I don't know.
No, well, I think I wouldn't want to have done these first two books by myself. It's just a lot of work, and I think we really built off each other's strengths on that. So, yeah.
Good, nice. So let's talk about this new book, A Threat of the First Magnitude. It's FBI counterintelligence and infiltration from the Communist Party of the Revolutionary Union in 1962 to 1974.
Yeah, you know, I really wish I could do, you know, we could figure out shorter titles that would say it all, but, you know, sometimes you just can't get away with that. Threat of the First Magnitude refers to an FBI assessment of the Revolutionary Union, Revolutionary Communist Party. They, in the mid-70s, they said it was a threat to the internal security of the United States of the first magnitude. And, you know, on the one hand, it's probably way exaggerated. On the other hand, it was the biggest Maoist group in the United States. China was the biggest radical communist country in the world. So it wasn't just an exaggeration. I mean, it's one of these things where two kind of opposite things are true. So Threat of the First Magnitude is the title we gave it. But the book kind of, the genesis of the book was we got all kinds of documents based on the first book. The first book was a profile of this specific Maoist group, the Revolutionary Union / it became the Revolutionary Communist Party. We finished the book and thousands more pages kept coming in.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, we went to our new publisher, Repeater Books, who are doing some very, you know, interesting and very cool things. And
Repeater Books, Repeater.
Repeater Books, okay. Yeah. They're, you know, the guy Tarek, I'm having a mental blip, but Tarek at Repeater had actually initiated Zero Books, and he left Zero and he started Tarek Goddard. Cool. And he started Repeater, so he's got a good...
he's got a good sense of what's going
on. Yeah, and he's got a good array of writers. So so we say, Tarek, we want to write a book of documents, you know, because we got all this stuff. And he says, yeah, good, go for it. But as we went through the documents, we started realizing there was a story. And the story wasn't just the nasty things the FBI did against the Maoists. The story was the way the FBI seems to have had as a doctrine getting informants to the leading levels of organization. And this is like some cunning stuff.
Okay, look, slow down for me and the punks for a second here, Aaron. So you went at it looking for one thing, and really you came out saying the FBI is not only looking for informants, they're also like pushing people to the brink of leadership in these organizations.
Exactly. Okay. And that, right. You know, I mean, look, they're doing all kinds of stuff, but The real story was, you know, we found, like, going back to Russian history, the Russian Revolution, there was this guy Malinovsky. He was Lenin loved this guy Malinovsky. Malinovsky's a working class guy, but he's an intellectual. He's the kind of guy that Lenin feels is the revolution, you know, these educated workers. Malinovsky's also kind of a criminal.
So I like him already. He sounds like a good guy.
No, he's not a good guy. He gets compromised by the Tsarist police, and they flip him.
Hmm.
They say, you know, Roman, that's his name, Roman Malinovsky, we'll give you a choice. You can go to prison, or we'll give you a bunch of money and you can inform on the Bolsheviks. And Roman, he liked that kind of lifestyle.
Sure.
He ends up on the Central Committee of the Bolsheviks. He ends up on the three-man committee that's set up by Lenin to get rid of spies.
Wow.
So he owns the keys to the safe. And he operates, you know, for years he becomes their representative in the Russian Congress, which is called the Duma. Eventually, you know, I guess he has some kind of breakdown. He runs away, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, the only reason we know Malinovsky's a spy is because there was a revolution in Russia. And the Kerensky people, they were the government between Lenin and the Tsar. The Kerensky people got at the police files. So, you know, Malinovsky's this big, you know, jefe, big jefe spy, but he's actually kind of a model for what we found later on.
Hmm.
You know, in the FBI files, you know, in the, you know, we have a little chapter on Malinovsky, but then we talk mainly about these more, you know, contemporary people.
So what are we looking at? Like, how, we're not talking about Central Committees, obviously. We're not, the people, these informants aren't getting up to that high in these organizations, right? I mean, what are we talking about? Like, how do the FBI infiltrate these things?
Yeah, well, you know, I would have said yes to that.
Oh, really?
If you'd asked me, you know, 5 years ago. Mm. But in fact, you know, what we discovered is, there's this character in the Revolutionary Union named Don Wright, African-American man. He's kind of a badass. He is said to have come out of the Black Panther Party in Chicago. He's said to be part of this super secret, really radical faction in the old Communist Party. But then, you know, we kind of looked into his background and all these funny things come up about him. So in the course of the book, we spend a fair amount of time uncovering the fact that he is, in fact, an FBI informant. Now, he, you know, at first we thought, well, Don Wright gets up to the Central Committee of this group.
Oh, wow.
But we discover he actually goes a level higher to the Secretariat.
Jesus.
Which is the four people that run the group day to day. So he's in a position to know everything, and he's in a position to influence things. But he's, you know, he's like a Malinovsky.
How did you, like, I have so many questions about what that even means, and, like, the, I guess, the epistemological way you understand that those things are true, like getting FBI files. Let's start with that. Obviously, I don't trust the government, and getting government files is a radical. And as someone who understands what the power of the state, how do you trust that file is true? I know on one side it's like, well, they're going to go through and doctor all these fucking files. It seems so conspiratorial, and obviously we're not conspiracy theorists. None of us are, you know, running around saying some crazy Alex Jones shit. But how do we know that they're not just doctoring those to make good people look bad in the FBI files?
Well, you know, that's
a fucked up question?
It's a very good question, and we get it quite a bit. And, you know, there's an example, you know, we can come back to in a little bit. But, you know, there's a colleague of mine, this historian Art Eckstein, who's, you know, he's not quite on the left in the way I am. But he wrote a book about the Weather Underground, you know, recently, a couple years ago. And there's a lot of useful information in there. But one of the things he points out that I think is an important thought is, look, the FBI doesn't write these documents for you and me. These are not press releases. These are internal papers and record keeping for them. They were never meant to be public. And in fact, you know, Connor, who is
your co-author.
He's over in China. I mean, he kind of remarks, like, the Freedom of Information Act, which is this law that says people in the United States should have access to a wide array of public records, It, you don't have this around the world. Mm. You know, we have it here because everything went to hell after the Vietnam War. The FBI got caught doing a lot of illegal stuff. The powers that be, as it were, needed to kind of restore legitimacy. So they had these laws. So these documents we're reading, you know, we were not supposed to read. And I think if J. Edgar Hoover and, you know, W. Mark Felt had their way, nobody would have ever seen them. And they would have liked to destroy a lot of the stuff. And that's actually what we found is when they can get away with destroying it, they do. But by and large, no, they're not. You know, they're not writing documents that they ever expected anybody to read. You know, would they doctor stuff? Sure. A lot of things are possible. But the thing is, you know, in working on this, you got to get to the fact that not what's possible, but what is there evidence for?
Mm.
Because, you know, unless there's evidence, like, just take the Joey file, right?
Mm, probably, you know, entertaining file.
Yeah, but like, how many person hours does it take to make that into something else? Because they got to know right. you, they got to know the people you know, they got to know the chronologies, they got to know your psychology to make it convincing. Otherwise, it's going to kind of jump out at you. It's possible.
Yeah.
But like, there ought to be a trail of evidence showing that, you know, they were screwing around.
Right. It wouldn't really make sense otherwise, too. It wouldn't fit into a larger historical piece. Like, it just wouldn't make sense.
Yeah,
like,
get a life.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah
they
yeah.
got better things to do, really.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about then, like, what impact these informants have or these infiltrators have. You know, so we see, you talked about, what was it, Bill Wright? Who was it?
Don Wright.
Don Wright, sorry. Talk about Don Wright getting up into the Secretariat through the Central Committee. What was, in doing this work, did you see the FBI, that the U.S. government had like a central strategy for these infiltrators? Were they trying to do a single thing? Like, was there a single narrative that the FBI was telling these infiltrators to, like, steer this shit off the cliff? Like, where were they telling them to go?
You know, you've got to piece it together, and I can't really answer that. I mean, Don Wright appeared to have a mission. He appeared to be trying to accomplish some things. There is no smoking gun. There is no business plan. Here's the FBI business plan that we expect Don Wright to accomplish over the course of 3 years of infiltration. I mean, it's like a freelancer who go, you know, the way we read it is he goes in and he does certain things and certain things happen and we have to try to analyze it. We do know that Don Wright is in leadership of this group at a pivotal moment for what was called the New Communist Movement. That was this effort to kind of, you know, build a Maoist party, which is a much more radical kind of communism than Soviet communism was. But there's a project to unite a bunch of groups into a single party. And we do know, we do have documentation from former informants who said, he was a former FBI informant, who said, my mission was to make sure these groups did not come together.
Oh,
so we look at what Don Wright did, and what he did is his biggest claim to fame is he sabotaged this entity that was called the National Liaison Committee, which was supposed to unite this Puerto Rican revolutionary group called, it used to be the Young Lords Party. It changed its name to the Puerto Rican Revolutionary Workers Organization. That was one group in this coalition. The Black Workers Congress was this radical black Marxist-Leninist working class group. They were supposed to be united. And the Revolutionary Union, they were supposed to be united. There was an Asian group called I War Kuhn. The group October League, another group of radicals out of SDS, a former student group, and this radical weekly newspaper, The Guardian. All these groups were supposed to come together as one. Don Wright sat on the coalition to unite, you know, three or four of the groups specifically, and he promoted the opposite of what he was supposed to promote. He was supposed to promote, let's have one group where all nationalities are working together and being great revolutionaries together, black, white, Latin, Asian. You know, he went in and said, well, black people ought to have their own organizations. They ought to lead. you know, Puerto Rican people ought to lead Puerto Rican people. Maybe we can be together in a kind of a coalition, blah, blah, blah. But pushed the whole other way. And the outcome was the coalition fell apart. The party never came together. You know, the Revolutionary Union went on to form a party as a mainly white group. And they took a kind of a very conservative position in the wake of that.
Yeah.
You know, kind of the opposite of what they had said in many ways before then.
And people talk about, I know this isn't the point that you're trying to make with it, but people talk about the, like the, you know, how little one person can change by themselves. But if you look at the power, like what one infiltrator could do in that context and how much that changed possible the history of the world in terms of, you know, radicals getting together and actually, you know, exerting power together. It's terrifying to think about that. It's pretty upsetting.
Yeah. It's stuff I really puzzle over a lot because, you know, I don't really think it's like the FBI is this big puppet master and they make everything happen. You know, I mean, they're a group with their own problems and they don't have the ability to do everything. And, you know, at the end of everything, I think the groups we write about are ultimately the author of their own destiny, or, in other words, you know, they got the power to determine who they are and who they're going to be. But I think too often people say things like, well, you know, as bad as groups like the FBI are, you know, they didn't stop us. And they ignore the actual impact of what a group like the FBI does. I mean, the FBI is not just there, you know, making themselves feel good. It actually has an impact. It has an impact when you have somebody on your secretariat who's an informant. And I think for these folks, I mean, there's like a lot of people now experimenting with socialism and communism and radical politics. And they need to kind of get hip to the fact that the people they're up against, they're smart people. You know, but they can be incredibly stupid. They can be really obvious, you know, like all of us. But they can also be really cunning and really have a long view on how to go about things. But it's just kind of getting the reality is like the FBI can't control everything. Yeah, we're the author of our own destiny.
Right.
On the other hand, what they do matters. And to the degree, you know, one isn't a victim of that, you know, it seems to me is kind of a, if I were in a radical organization, which I'm not, I would not want to be victimized like that.
And did you find that this Don Wright situation was a pretty common situation where the FBI might have not had a super clear agenda, but they wanted to, disenfranchise, or they just wanted to keep people from coming together? Was that a common thread that you saw in a lot of these infiltrations and a lot of these informant situations?
I think mainly what Don Wright is a very unique thing because there's some very specific things were going on in history, but this took me back because, like, what we discovered is the FBI, they had a big head start on this stuff. You know, these young people who became radicals in 1968, 1970, you know, they got a year or two's experience. The FBI, you know, they've been in the business of sabotaging leftism for, like, you know, 40 years beforehand. So we found this character from like 1952, Morris Childs.
Morris Childs.
Morris Childs.
It's an exciting name.
Yeah, it is. And him and his brother Jacob, you know, Jack Childs. These guys are like, mid-level leadership in the Communist Party, the old pro-Soviet Communist Party. And, Morris Childs is in the late 40s, he's essentially kind of pushed out of the party. You know, there's like some internal argument and he's on the wrong side of it.
The Communist Party.
Yeah, and he's on the wrong side of it and his health starts to deteriorate. His wife leaves him. His old friends don't talk to him. He's up in his apartment. He's bitter. And the FBI comes knocking on his door.
Okay.
And they send this intellectual guy named Carl Freeman. You know, he's trained as a lawyer. And he says, Morris, you know, come work for us. You know, these communists, you know, look what they're doing, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's, you know, I'm giving you the short version.
Right,
but
right.
Over the course of many kind of deep intellectual
discussions.
You
got to get the book for the long version.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There you go, right? And yeah, we have There's pictures in the book.
Yeah, there right? you go. You can see exactly what Morris Rouse looks like. Exactly.
Yeah, it is my dream that someday my books will be a Saturday morning cartoon show.
Yeah, the Morris Childs episode is getting exciting. So what do they say? They said Morris Childs, don't make us wait for the cartoon version here, Aaron. What happened?
So they have these intellectual talks with him. They also say, we're going to take you up to the Mayo Clinic and get you some treatment for your heart disease because you're on your own. So he buys it. He goes it and he becomes an FBI informant for like the next, 25 years. You know, he is like, you know, the leader of the Communist Party, you know, in the late 50s, this guy, Gus Hall. Morris Childs becomes Gus Hall's ambassador. He becomes his secretary of state. You can see pictures of Morris Childs sitting at a table with Leonid Brezhnev, the head of the Soviet Union. Morris Childs meets with Mao Zedong. He meets with Zhou Enlai.
Wow.
He meets with all of them. He's an FBI informant.
Jesus Christ.
You know, he's at the very top, and he's the guy who brings the money from the Soviets to the Communist Party, because the Communist Party doesn't have support right. otherwise. So he owns he just knows everything about this group. And he operates, you know, with impunity for decades. So this is the model. That comes, you know, this is the body of knowledge the FBI has. You know, they weren't just trying to figure this out yesterday. They, you know, they had big screw-ups, but they learned, right? And, you know, still, I'm sure there's a lot of people who are pretty, you know, unimpressive in the FBI, but they do seem to have had a few people who were actually kind of impressive in terms of what they knew from books and Marxism and things of that sort.
Let's take a little break. Let's listen to it. We're going to listen to a song, and then we're going to come back, and I'm going to ask Aaron what he thinks were some of the craziest things that he learned and looking at these files, like some of the weirdest little nuggets we can pick his brain with. So get down. Since earlier in the episode, we played a song from Tiger Man Woe, who we played with on this recent Skullcaster Escape from the Zoo tour, promoting our brand new split record, which you can get on our website, dispatchfromtheunderground.com. I wanted to play another tune. This is a band from Buffalo, conscious band, fucking powerful band. I really dig their music. They are called Grain Assault, not Grain of Salt, Grain, like bread, and Assault, like assault and battery. Grain of Salt. They're an amazing band. I play with them now twice, and I absolutely love this band. I played with them on the show before, and I just can't get enough of them. Their music is great, but honestly, nothing compares to their live show. They put on a fucking incredible show. So if you get a chance to see this band, make sure you check them out. Hopefully, they'll be playing Punk Island next year. I try to talk them into it. We'll see if we can get them down to do that. But they're an amazing band from Buffalo, New York. Here's Grain of Salt. Get them. All right, Aaron, let's get neck deep in this real quick. All right, I want to know what you feel is like the craziest, most noteworthy thing. Like, what do you think if we have to end this interview in the next, like, 2 minutes? Like, we've got to know before we end. Like, what is it?
Well, there was this group called the Ad Hoc Committee for a scientific socialist line.
That is a nerdy ass name.
Yeah, man. Well, it changed its name to something a little more popular, okay. Which was the Ad Hoc Committee for a Marxist-Leninist Party.
Okay.
And
we love our ad hocs.
Yeah, and it starts in 1962. And it's
so early.
Yeah, it's like and what it is like you got to get a little nerdy on communist politics with it. It's a pro-Maoist faction in the pro-Soviet Communist Party. So that's akin to having a pro-Trump faction in the Democratic Party. It okay. just does not work.
Okay.
Right? But this little entity, it claims it is. You know, we're a secret pro-Maoist among these pro-Soviet stodgy bureaucrats. And it's entirely an FBI concoction. You know,
What do you mean it's entirely an FBI concoction? I don't know. Like, can you say that?
This is like out of Austin Powers, right? You know, Austin Powers, he wakes up from the freeze and they're giving him his stuff. And he has the Swedish penis enlarger.
Okay.
And Austin says, oh, no, that's not my bag, man.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And then he pulls out the security guy has the book, Austin Powers, Swedish penis enlargers yeah, yeah. is my bag. That's the deal with the ad hoc committee. We got the personnel file of this guy, Carl Freeman. Carl Freeman recruited Morris Childs. Okay. Carl Freeman's personnel file has this whole thing of... he's talking about somebody who works for him. And it says, this agent, Herb Stallings, out of his own imagination, created a phony pro-Maoist entity in the Communist Party. So this is the Austin Power Swedish penis enlargement statement. Out of his own imagination, he created this totally fictitious group. Mm. And it's just like a phony bulletin, right, that they pass around. The FBI prints it and... they give it to some informants and they pass it around in the group. But over time, this group, this thing goes on for like 17 years.
Okay.
There are like 50 to 70,000 pages on this group, right?
And it was entirely created by the FBI. And it was the reason is to like just...
to sabotage the Communist Party.
Just cause problems.
Yeah, because like if you're saying you like Mao and you're in the Communist Party, you get kicked out.
Right, right.
You know, kicking people out, creating problems. That's what the FBI was all about at that time.
I got it. That makes sense. Okay.
So this group goes on for 17 years, and they target the Communist Party. But, you know, our friend Don Wright, you know, basically his resume as being a radical is he came out of a super secret pro-Maoist faction in the old Communist Party. That's how he's described, which says to me he was part of this ad hoc committee. So there's like 50 to 70,000 pages. And I suspect if we read all those right now, a lot of our conception of 60s radicalism and how things went will be changed. Mm. Because, you know, this was powerful medicine, you know, because it had a legitimacy and people didn't know it was the FBI. So, and I do feel like Glenn Beck when I talk about it.
Why?
Well, him and his charts of, you know, here's the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and, you know. Yeah. Except this is all documented. So, mm-hmm. you know, you can look at the documents and you can tell us where we saw things that didn't exist. And you know, you're not going to do that. I mean, maybe we analyzed some things wrong. But by and large, I think, you know, with the Connor and my work and this guy, David Sullivan, who passed away, he left something in the file. He was kind of on the trail, but he never got the... Swedish penis enlargement memo, which we did.
Yeah.
We Googled it, right?
Yeah.
We took something from David Sullivan and we took what we knew and we Googled those two things, and that's when this personnel file showed up. So yeah, that was a revelatory thing. And if we ever, you know, I'll get a couple hundred pages a year until I'm probably 120. And you know, we'll talk more about it next time I'm here in 20 years, right?
I will hopefully be here too with you, Aaron. I feel like you're going to get to that 120 and I might make it to like 60 if I'm lucky. Let's talk about, you were talking about in the break before we got back on the episode, we talked about Steve Aoki.
Richard Aoki. Steve Aoki is, it's confusing, right? Because I guess he's a singer or something.
Sorry.
Richard Aoki is he's this Japanese American guy. Who was a radical. His claim to fame is he helped get the Black Panthers their first guns so they could do their, you know, monitoring the police patrols.
I think I saw that in the Mario Van Peebles film.
Yeah, so Richard Aoki is, you know, in the last few years, he's become kind of an icon. You know, Asian American activists kind of said, "Oh, this guy's really cool." And you know, I'm kind of, you know, I'm really down with that spirit.
Yeah,
you know, of like, let's look at our elders and see who we can draw some inspiration from. But unfortunately, you know, this journalist, Seth Rosenfeld, discovered evidence that Aoki had been an FBI informant. So the whole thing gets to be really messy. You know, Aoki is actually somebody who joins the Army Reserves in the late 50s. And how do people become FBI informants? Well, here's how Richard Aoki became an FBI informant. He joins the Army, and it's the Cold War, so you have to answer this Cold War question. Are you now or have you ever been a communist? And he says, no. And then the next question is, do you know anybody? And he says, yes. And then he writes down three names, including some girl he dated. You know, so this is how Richard Aoki became a snitch. You know, military intelligence sent that report to the FBI. The FBI said, we can work with this.
Wow.
They go to Aoki and say, would you like to go to some meetings and tell us who goes to them? And so he informs for like until 1977. So from like the late 50s to 1977, and nobody's on to him, you know, because he's like a small, radical Japanese guy, and he's not, you know, the picture people have in mind when they think of an informant. But the story gets weird, and I think the reason we spent so much time on it is because these documents started coming out, and some people on the left, their reflex was to continue to defend Aoki and say, look, this is just, they're just trying to trash this guy and make, you know, all of us look bad. They're trying to trash our legacy and stuff. One of the points, you know, we get at in the book is some of the very people who were defending Aoki actually deserve the respect as being radicals that they were given to Aoki. Aoki doesn't. He lies.
Right. These are good people who are trying to defend a not good person.
Yeah, and they don't need to go looking for somebody to extol.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they were part of movements that demanded ethnic studies, demanded equality and things of this sort in like 69 and 70 and stuff. And Aoki, you know, unfortunately, it's like the uncomfortable truth is there's like 2,000 pages of files on this guy, you know, of his reports, of naming names, including naming the names of the people who defended him. So we wanted to try to get this out, but we didn't even just rely on the FBI documents. We actually went back and looked at Aoki's interviews and got the contradictions, you know, in his own words, you know, and in that way, I think we built a pretty compelling case for why everything in the, why the FBI files, where you got to take it with a grain of salt. I mean, these guys are, FBI guys are writing to their supervisors and they want to make themselves look good.
Right. So they're pumping it up a little bit.
But Aoki kind of reinforces the truth of the files. So, you know, there's a lot on it and there's a lot of lessons and stuff.
Is Richard Aoki still alive?
He committed suicide in 2009. He committed suicide fairly soon after this journalist said, you know, I understand you're a, it's a very interesting thing. You can listen to the tape on the internet, but this journalist said, look, Bernie Threadgill, who's a retired FBI agent, Bernie Threadgill says, you were an informant. And Richard Aoki's response was, oh, he said that. Now, Connor actually joked to me as if somebody said to you, oh, Connor, I think you're an FBI informant, the natural reaction would be, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, you fucking kidding me? I'll fucking punch him right in the mouth. Yeah.
But Richard was, he said that. And he later went on and he denied it. But, I mean, that's anecdotal. That's not evidence.
Right, right.
But it's part of a bigger picture.
Wow. Well, that's some heavy shit. That's pretty intense stuff. So people were aware of these things for a little bit. They've been aware of the fact that he's been labeled and informed for a while. But you guys really laid it all out. And, like,
yeah, and
all
you look at the documents, man. It's... this is the guy when Huey Newton had a shootout with his officer, Frey.
Sure, famous.
Yeah, and he was up for murdering a cop.
Yep.
You know, Richard Aoki the next day told the FBI that Newton was driving his girlfriend's car. So he fingered Newton right away. This is not a friend of the people.
Right.
You know, by any stretch. And it's, you know, look, there's uncomfortable truths, but the truth is kind of good. It's a helpful thing.
Even a lot of people say that, yeah.
Yeah, even if, well, it's...
Yeah, yeah.
It's easier said than done, too.
Also, I would truthfully say thank you, Aaron and Connor, for reading these documents and making me not have to read them to find this truth, because, you know, that's a lot of heavy work, and you guys really, you know, sussed it all out. And I'll say, having known you guys... that I don't trust anyone as much as I trust you two to painstakingly go through this stuff and be on the side of the people of the world, but also to tell the truth. You know, like, there are very few intellectuals out there, I think, that would painstakingly go through this truth for the people. You know, like, they might do it for themselves, or they might do it for glory, or they might do it for some, you know, I don't know what the fuck they would do it for, but I know you guys are doing it for good reasons, and I know you guys are also doing it for the truth, and I'm very happy that you're doing it, and I'm very happy that I don't have to. So thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome.
Yeah.
You know, it's the thing where it's, for me, it's like, I just don't, I've made this point. I don't want people victimized by the same tricks. You know, I don't want the, I mean, there's an analogy there. It isn't in my head, but it's like, people have gone through this stuff. And, you know, the double sin, to really use that religious term, would be victimized by the same trick. And, you know, if we can help people avoid that. I mean, you know, we're not out to be a build a big organizing, you know, auxiliary and stuff. But if there's any benefit there, I think that's what it is.
Well, if people are going to be doing radical work, they should be reading these books to understand at least what's already been done so they don't fall victim to the same traps. It's pretty simple. If you want to do that stuff, you better know what's been done, because the FBI has done it all before and they seem to be doing it all again. And we've seen it within our activists, you know, the last 10 years. We've seen infiltration time and time again. People just keep ignoring it and acting like it's not working and acting like they're too good to have to deal with it and not vetting their friends because they're friends. But, you know, the FBI holds leverage over people, and the FBI and the government are powerful institutions, and you can't understand how this is all going to go unless you know what's been done.
Yeah, and, you know, to the degree you understand it better, you're not going to go crazy and do stupid things about being paranoid about people and making accusations and behaving inappropriately. You know, the best you can do is the best you can do. Try to understand things as they actually are. You know, don't get super paranoid, and, you know, because that too is, that's actually a tried and true method the FBI does, is try to make people suspicious of one another. I know that's a paradox, but, you know, you got to proceed from evidence. If there's no evidence, you know, you got to calm down.
Thank you guys for doing this stuff. Again, the book is called A Threat of the First Magnitude. The subtitle is FBI Counterintelligence and Infiltration from the Communist Party to the Revolutionary Union, 1962 to 1974. All right, Aaron, where can people get this book? You said Repeater Books.
Yeah, well, I know some people have an aversion to Amazon, but that's an easy way to do it. But there's different distributors. Just Google the title, and there's all kinds of places you can buy it online. I don't know what stores in New York carry it, but if you go to my website, AaronLeonard.net, that's AaronLeonard.net. I have a list of stores that actually carry it. And I do encourage people to go in and buy a hard copy and support these independent bookstores.
All right, everyone, get out there, get this for, I don't know if people are buying Halloween presents or Thanksgiving presents, but you can start that tradition, I guess, if people aren't doing that, but definitely Christmas is right around the corner. Get this for the intellectual in your family or the activist in your family. If you know someone who's like an activist and maybe, you know, or aspiring activist, this might be a good book for them to get into to avoid, you know, any paranoid tendencies they have about the FBI, and something that can help them understand a little bit of the historical understanding of where this stuff's coming from. Yeah, there it is. Well, we will post that on our Facebook page too. You guys can go to Dispatch from the Underground on Facebook and find a link to AaronLeonard.net. Aaron, thanks so much for coming on. Thanks for writing the book.
Hey, thank you. It's my pleasure.
If you see Connor, tell him no thank you. I tell him I give all my gratitude to you and that I had nothing kind to say about him.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll take that as exactly as you mean it.
Cool. I appreciate that. Yeah. All right. Everybody else out there, get down. I want to change the pace a little bit here. Aaron is in New York City because he's speaking at a forum where he's talking about the FBI files of Woody Guthrie and Dave Van Ronk. And so I wanted to play some music from that. Obviously, this episode is going up after that speech. But I wanted to at least recognize that Aaron is an incredible person who's doing tons of amazing writing and research. And he's written these two books we're talked about on the show. But he's also doing a lot of other work with FBI files and understanding how this system oppresses, you know, incredible figures and turns things inside out and keeps track of good people. And so he's here talking about Woody Guthrie and Dave Van Ronk. So I'm going to be playing a tune from Woody Guthrie, music that I dig. I think you're going to dig too if you have an open mind about it. So here it is. Here's a little Woody Guthrie. Get down.
Boys, list them a tale, tell you I'm in trouble on the old Chisholm Trail. Come a kaya, yippee, 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 yay. Come a kaya, yippee, yippee, yay. Started up the trail October 23rd. Started up the trail with a two you heard. Come a kaya, yippee, 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 yay. Come a kaya, yippee, yippee, yay. $10 horse and a $40 saddle, and I'm gonna cut them Texas cattle. Come a kaya, yippee, 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 yay. Come a kaya, yippee, yippee, yay. Woke up one morning on old Chisholm Trail, my rope in my hand and a cow with a tail. Come a kaya, yippee, 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 yay. Come a kaya, yippee, yippee, yay. Cloudy in the west and I'm looking like rain, but dang those slickers in the wagon again. Come a kaya, yippee, 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 yay. Come a kaya, yippee, yippee, yay. Jumped in a saddle and I grabbed out a horn, the best blamed cowboy ever was born. Come a kaya, yippee, 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 yay. Come a kaya, yippee, yippee, yay. Don't give a damn if I never do stop. I ride just long as an 8-day clock. Come a kaya, yippee, 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 yay. Come a kaya, yippee, yippee, yay. Put in a stirrup and a hand on the horn, the best dang cowboy ever was born. Come a kaya, yippee, 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 yay. Come a kaya, yippee, yippee, yay. Stray in the herd, the boss said kill it. Hit him in the rump with the handle of the skillet. Come a kaya, yippee, 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 yay. Come a kaya, yippee, yippee, yay. Bacon and beans most every day. Soon to be eating that prairie hay. Come a kaya, yippee, 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 yay. Come a kaya, yippee, yippee, yay. Best thing horse going on the run. Quick to shoot cowboy ever pulled a gun. Come a kaya, yippee, 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 yay. Come a kaya, yippee, yippee, yay. Well, I went to the wagon to get my roll. Had me figure $9 in the hole. Come a kaya, yippee, 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 yay. Come a kaya, yippee, yippee, yay. Well, sell my outfit quick as I can. I won't punch cattle for no damn man. Come a kaya, yippee, 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 yay. Come a kaya, yippee, yippee, yay. Going to town to draw my money. Going to town to see my honey. Come a kaya, yippee, 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 yay. Come a kaya, yippee, yippee, yay. Knees in the saddle and my seat in the sky. Quit my boss and say goodbye. Come a kaya, yippee, 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 yay. Come a kaya, yippee, yippee, yay.
All right, that's the end of the episode. I want to say thank you again to Aaron Leonard and my good friend Connor Gallagher all the way over in Shanghai who wrote this book with Aaron. The book, again, is called A Threat of the First Magnitude. It's the subtitle is FBI Counterintelligence and Infiltration from the Communist Party to the Revolutionary Union, 1962 to 1974. This is their second book. Their other book, Heavy Radicals, was put out on Zero. What was it? It was put out on Zero Books, and this was on Repeater Books. They are available pretty much everywhere. If you just look for the titles on Amazon, you can go and get those books. If you're not into buying it on Amazon, as Aaron said, just go to your local bookstore and tell them to order it, and you know, you can support that bookstore that way and support Aaron that way. And I'm sure both institutions are, I guess, Aaron and Connor are not institutions, but well, not yet at least. Both entities would appreciate that. So thank you. Thank you, fellas. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Connor. Thank you again to everybody who listens to Dispatches every single week. I appreciate y'all tuning in. I appreciate y'all getting reflective and being conscious and empowering others to get to this world that yearns to be called into being. Please, if you have a chance, spread this show elsewhere. Go on to wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a rating. Say you dig the show or say you hate it. Honestly, whatever. I just think that the more people know about it, the better chance they have to get down with it. And I think it's worth getting down with. If you do listen regularly and you appreciate what we do, there is a donate button on our website, dispatchersfromtheunderground.com. You can leave $5, $10, $1,000, however you feel it would help the show. We would appreciate y'all donating. If not, there's a merch section too. I know Christmas is coming, so or Hanukkah or whatever you celebrate, or if you just buy presents for people because you care about them. There's a bunch of really great shit on our merch page, and all of that is on our website, dispatchingtheunderground.com. Anyway, this show will always be free. It'll be out there for anyone to check out. Go to dispatchingtheunderground.com, check it out, spread it around. Hopefully people can continue to listen, continue to be conscious, continue to be empowered, and get to this better world that we all demand that comes into existence, a radical left-wing world where this right-wing bullshit doesn't hold us back and where people can feel like they can freely associate without any of these fetters that were constantly placed on us. Until then, we all have a lot more fighting to do, a lot more listening to do, a lot more talking to do, a lot more getting down to do. So hopefully this show and the music we play and the culture and the world that we bring into being can all push us further to that world we want to get to. Until then, I hope you all tell everyone to get down. I have to admit that I did not know who Dave Van Ronk was before this. We aired this show. I know Aaron was coming here to speak about how the FBI had files on Woody Guthrie and Dave Van Ronk, but I was not familiar with Dave Van Ronk. So this is my introduction and likely your introduction to Dave Van Ronk. Hope you dig it. Yeah, check it out. It's Dave Van Ronk. Get down.
Hang me, oh, hang me, I'll be dead and gone. Hang me, oh, hang me, I'll be dead and gone. Wouldn't mind the hanging, but the laying in the grave so long. Poor boy, I've been all around this world. I've been all around Cape Girardeau, parts of Arkansas. All around Cape Girardeau, parts of Arkansas. Got so goddamn hungry, I could hide behind a straw. Poor boy, I've been all around this world. Went up on the mountain, there I made my stand. Went up on the mountain, there I made my stand. Rifle on my shoulder and a dagger in my hand. Poor boy, I've been all around this world. Hang me, oh, hang me, and I'll be dead and gone. Hang me, oh, hang me, and I'll be dead and gone. Wouldn't mind the hanging, but the laying in the grave so long. Poor boy, I've been all around this world. Put the rope around my neck, hung me up so high. Put the rope around my neck, hung me up so high. Last words I heard him say, won't be long now before you die. Poor boy, I've been all around this world. Hang me, oh, hang me, and I'll be dead and gone. Hang me, oh, hang me, I'll be dead and gone. Wouldn't mind the hanging, but the laying in the grave so long. Poor boy, I've been all around this world.